Whenever I get a chance to talk to Bartan, I consider it an honor and a privilege. Seated in his company, I count myself in the presence of the Oracle of Delphi. And certainly it's true that nobody among us these days knows more than Bartan about the theory and practice of philanthropy. It's been the story of his life as a teacher, writer, and administrator, as the holder of 16 honorary degrees in history and the humanities, as the president of the New York Public Library in the 1980s, as president of Brown University in the 1990s, and now for the last 16 years as president of the Carnegie Corporation. And I come with three questions. I have any more, but I'll start with three. How define the word philanthropy? In Greek myth, it is the crime committed by Prometheus by his stealing fire from the gods and bringing it to mankind as a free gift. How measure the value of philanthropy to the health and well-being of human society? Not only our own 21st century American society, but in all societies, ancient and modern, east and west of Suez. How does the philanthropic spirit inform Thomas Paine's idea of democracy, resting on the belief that the strength of government and the happiness of the governed is the freedom of the common people to mutually support one another? And Bartan, you begin with whatever question suits your fancy, or, as often happens when people went up to talk to the Oracle chose to answer none of the questions.
Okay, let me start stating the fact that all the religions, especially Abrahamic faiths, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, have as a provision that giving is required as a religious duty, as an act of charity. Charity without judgment. Charity is natural humaneness and humanity of individual that ties to them. The pity, out of sympathy, but no obligation without judgment. Somebody's begging, you give, you don't tell him, why don't you go to work? But that's a judgment. You give because it was assumed always that there'll be destitutes in life who cannot help themselves. So you have to help them. Philanthropy was a much more modern term, especially in the 19th century, but given a scientific allure or tenor, dealing with the causes of poverty rather than poverty itself. You try to deal with this, not symptom, but the causes. For example, by establishing hospitals, poor houses, orphanages, and all of this, so you deal about a collective issue rather than an individual issue. Now, philanthropy is a very loaded word. When I went to Mexico to discuss with Mexican millionaires the act of giving, I did not realize that in Mexico and Latin America, especially places where Catholic Church had been strong during colonial period, that was associated with charity, they did not want the church once again to enter in the realm of philanthropy, because philanthropy is the state's obligation. State is the philanthropy business. Church has to be in the charity business. Because assuming philanthropy business, it gets them into politics. Alliance with colonial power and so on. They had stripped church of the philanthropy component because it gave them idea that they were representing the people, people's welfare, as an antidote to the government.
Well, philanthropy in that context is like the fire from Prometheus. It's energy.
Yes.
And it's possibility and it's opening horizon. And Tocqueville talks about it in the United States in 1831 and talks about volunteerism, people helping each other on their various projects that in Europe would have to have been done by a leading aristocrat or by the government, but in the United States by association. Again, along Paine's line of democracy, people helping each other.
Yeah. That's true. Actually, the Todd Wheel's Democracy in America is still a classic, even though at the time he came, he dealt with America, an agrarian nation. He did not go to a single university for it at the time. There were not many of them. But he was impressed by the fact that he coined a new term to define, which he said, individualism. There was no such term as individualism. He coined it to attribute American character being individualistic, individualism. But it did not mean individualism, the current understanding, namely self-centeredness, self-isolation, selfishness. And in his words, America always dealt through associations for self-help. But also, American individualism, unlike European one, you deferred gratification. There was no instant gratification. I'm going to Satwam to help with everybody. It was that idea of deferring private good for public good, reconciling the two, which may impress the topic very much, the same way as pain. Because freedom was freedom to be able not to gratify, but also to be in charge of your future, to delay gratification. Otherwise, it became desperation. It was one of the things that impressed. But that, the Tocqueville was not alone. Arabella, when pilgrims came, the compact that they made, self-help, already is there. And this was not their invention. They came from societies in which this was happening. There were more associations, so much so that in his farewell address, George Washington expressed already anxiety and fear that all these institutions, associations that are emerging will be dangerous maybe for American democracy, because they're not only individualistic, which we defined it, they will do segmental factions at the expense of the country. And how to reconcile, therefore, the unique with the universal, individual with collectivity, and collectivity with the national nation's future. That was the discussion that they had.
They also had a discussion. A democratic society puts a premium on equality.
Yes.
A capitalist economy does not. And how do you reconcile those two objectives? And then the question comes, and I'm asking you this question. Philanthropy, does it mean directed toward one's fellow man, toward other individuals, toward the other people in this room, or is it to build the glory and majesty of the state?
Well, there are many, naturally, divisions on this issue. There are critics who said philanthropy is subsidized tax support by the state. There are those who say philanthropy allows to become plutocracy, rich to do what they please, shaping public policy. And they also say, like I do, that United States, unlike Europe, does not have Ministry of Education, Ministry of Culture, Ministry of Health, that's in charge of everything. In the absence of national institutions, associations have filled the vacuum in the United States, which is unheard of in Europe. When I went to NYU to speak to 40, 50 European university presidents about fundraising, president of the University of Amsterdam raised his hand and said, "Mr. Gregorian, I'm afraid to tell you, if I try to fundraise, I'll be jailed." Because Holland and Denmark and others, state's duty to support higher education. You don't go and ask individuals to give money to do what state has an obligation to do. Well, we don't have that system. And also, we have a system, we have 19th century system, which is no longer completely satisfies 21st century needs. Because our system was to delay, not to expedite, unless there's World War I, World War II, and so forth. And it has had its bearings, slowing process till everybody adopts it. But we don't have that luxury anymore. So, coming back to your question, one of the reasons is that there have been capitalists, because we cannot just put all the capitalists in the same line, who have been anti-capitalists in principle. Andrew Carnegie wrote a magnificent book about American democracy. And he also believed that capitalists are trustees of public wealth. It does not belong to them. This was a radical idea in the 19th century. Capitalists, trustees of public wealth. If the public had trusted you to become rich, it's public that made me rich, and you have an obligation to return. We come always back to the Gospel of Wealth, which he wrote, which was a very dangerous principle at the time. It got criticized. What he said is, biblical terms, which Rockefeller used, he did not use, to whom much is given, much is expected. And yes, Manuela, we always believed, especially Jews, that shrouds have no pockets. You cannot take to the other world. So you might as well do something here in the world. Either through religious impulse, which was Rockefeller's, or through humanistic impulse, which was Andrew Carnegie's. He truly believed that the wealth you have to return to the public. Invest in public, not give it away. Invest. If you read his prenuptial agreement with his wife, two paragraphs, I'm going to give all my money away. There were no lawyers to say, how much are you saving for the family and so forth. As a matter of fact, his great-grandchildren came. I introduced them at a meeting. He said, sorry, we have no money. Our great-grandfather did not leave anything. And he also said the most dangerous thing, which I have used once in a while. Mr. Drexel is here. I used him in Newport, to my great detriment. He used the concept that aristocracy is like potatoes. The best part is underground. You cannot brag about your ancestors. Who are you? What are you doing to deserve your ancestors? Again, coming back to individualism. And the last point is, he believed in investing rather than alleviating. Well, said, person who is hungry, don't give him a fish, but give him a fishing rod. Make him independent rather than interdependent. And he believed in equality, even though he did not practice in his business dealings, because he was former socialist. He believed in socialism, one way or another. So I'm just begging your tolerance that all capitalists were not uniformly capitalistic. Some of them were weird. Some of them were original. Some of them were, highly individualistic. And they set the norm. All the big capitalists since then, they all called Andrew Carnegie's Gospel of Wealth as having influenced them. Because this idea, yes, prompted Manuela sometimes by craving for immortality, sometimes guilt, sometimes vanity, sometimes anonymity. Because one of the things that I've been surprised, I've dealt with many of the wealthy people, the benefactors, what moves them to do that? Because in my opinion, there are three institutions, two, that give you earthly immortality. One are libraries, when all the works of Lewis Lapham will be preserved in one form or another for eternity. The other is museums. Other than that, no rabbi, no priest can promise you immortality in the next world, or this world. Buildings don't. Pan Am building is gone. MetLife is there. MetLife will go, something else will come. Buildings don't. As later Leon Levy told Philip Montebello, he said, your collection will be at the Metropolitan Museum for perpetuity. And Leon Levy said, how long is perpetuity nowadays? And Philip said, 50 years. So make it 75 and we've got a deal. So even when I'm saying, even that does not last long. So one has to confront one's maker, one has to confront humanity. So psychologically, it's very difficult what motivates them. I, for one, I believe, like Machiavelli, that intention is not the issue, whatever intention is. Action is the issue. Did people benefit from your action? Yes. Then we don't have psychoanalysis. Why did he do that? In the case of Andrew Carnegie, there was this speculation that his firm shot workers killed, and therefore he tried to expiate his guilt or sin. That's why he started giving. What we know from his prenuptial agreement, that long predated the incident, the Hampstead incident. Right. So he decided to give all of it rather than part of it. And he did. And that's what's remarkable. So I just like to beg all of your attention that we cannot generalize about all the capitalists. There are some capitalists who are socialistic, some kind of revolutionary. As somebody wrote recently about Karl Marx, a biography of Karl Marx and Engels. Engels was multimillionaire, very rich, he drank champagne at parties and so forth, but he was Marxist. He did not mean he was poor to be Marxist. He was bourgeois Marxist. He enjoyed a good meal, drank a lot, and enjoyed that, and occasionally helped Karl Marx with subsidies for revolution.
Give us an idea of the scale of philanthropy in the United States today. I mean, the amount of money, the proportion of the GDP, the numbers of people who give money in different kinds of amounts. I'm always struck by the fact that the people who are relatively poor give a bulk of what is given every year. So what are those numbers? $300
billion? $357 billion, around $375, depending which you record. But remember, many people, most of the giving goes to religious institutions because of the fact that it's an obligation to give. Second, out of $300 billion, 65-70% is given by people who make less than $50,000. It's not very rich that give all the money. It's the people, because this is the only nation in the world that giving has become part of the ethos of being an American. Now, whether you believe in giving or not, it's become irrelevant. If you don't give, you're called cheapskate, not a good citizen. So much so that Europeans are always surprised that presidential candidates in the United States had to reveal their philanthropic giving, which has no relevance in politics in Europe. But we expect them also to show that they're generous people. Giving also is, in many ways, supporting 1,450,000 or 500,000 nonprofit organizations in this country, largest in the world, which constitutes our civil society. It's part of it comes this funding from foundations, some of it from government, private-public partnership. But it's amazing how generous Americans have been. Europe is now learning how to give. And also I have to remind you, because Nancy mentioned that people are giving because tax exemption. Neither Andrew Carnegie nor Rockefeller had tax exemption problems. Frankly, I mean, it wouldn't count. And there are articles written recently I was reading that charities or philanthropies cost the tax to the American public $56.5 billion tax benefit. Well, my answer is that will be 7 months of war in Afghanistan.
Yeah. All right. Isn't there some kind of bill floating around in Congress to remove the tax exemption from philanthropic gift?
Oh, they're talking about it, but it's not going to happen.
It's a bad idea.
No, it is a good idea. It won't happen, because that will be a big assault against one American major principle. Private property is my property. I can do what I want. And second is choice. And third one is, it goes to the heart of all the support against religious institutions. As long as religious institutions are there, tax will not change. Because most of the money goes to religious institutions, not foundations.
But a lot of the money also goes to provide hospitals, research universities, museums.
Yes.
I mean, there's a, as you say, the civil society, I mean, is being funded largely by philanthropy.
Exactly. People will say, what do foundations do? Well, foundations do what government cannot do. Government cannot start an initiative that fails. The senator and congressman who propose that initiative will be out of power. Philanthropy can do that. Philanthropy is a laboratory for the nation in many ways. You try, it's risk associated, a single unit. Once it succeeds, then you can carry scale. Government cannot. Government thinking long-term, other than military, there's no long-term planning. Military and maybe also energy storage and reserves and so forth. Long-term by 25 years, we don't have that. Foundations can provide that. You provide models that nation can adopt. The third thing is, as you mentioned, all art, practically, 90% is supported by philanthropies. Whether it's music, whether it's dance, whether museums, most of hospitals are supported by, in addition to Medicare and other charging more or less, is supported also by philanthropies. Most of the 1.4 million organizations, nonprofits, largest in the world, are supported by foundations and, you know, individual and other giving. And one out of 11 Americans now work for nonprofits. So it's also job creation. When you take job creation, that is job creation. One out of 11 Americans. And more people work for higher education now than automobile, steel, and textile industry, whatever is left of it. And I'm not saying the ones that have been reassembled in Mariana Islands saying made in USA. I'm talking about just in general what really is produced here.
The people, you know, since for the last 5 or 6 years we've been reading in the newspapers and the columns about American decline. People talk about the erosion of the democratic idea. They talk about our dysfunctional politics. They talk about the inequality between rich and poor. They talk about the poor degree of service being offered by the government to the various citizens, the failure of our infrastructures, and so on. And it is all of that sort of being shifted over onto the shoulders of the philanthropic, the NGOs, the thousands of foundations, the Carnegie, the private sector, the civil society. I mean, is that what is happening?
Well, that's what is the intent is. But civil society can take a role in so much. Remember one thing, and I hate to bring this up. Since 1776, every war we fought, including War of Independence, there was a plan to pay the cost. 1776, 1812, the Civil War even, World War I, World War II, even Korea to a certain extent. Beginning Vietnam, which slacked down, and then kept down, everything we charge on Visa card. Well, you know, you can't fight war with Visa card. So having spent $1 trillion+ in Iraq, $600 billion in Afghanistan, and now 130 other places we are active, you know, we can't afford it. We can't afford it because war is costly. We can't afford it because the world has many problems. And therefore, it's very important to see how we're going to be able to pay those. And blaming that on the nonprofits rather than having liberty, I propose, if we really believe in wars, we fight, let's have liberty bonds. Let's have U.S. bonds, the way we used to have. People can buy, invest, people who say, let's stand for our soldiers and so forth, who volunteer army fighting, they can invest. Private sector is doing a lot also to help every possible way.
Yeah.
But it's not, it cannot be in charge of the economy because we have a government, we have a Congress, we have all the others. And I'm mentioning $647 billion. I think that's the total endowment of all the foundations, including Gates and others. That is the cost of, again, I have to take just to give you an impression. That is, if we continue another half a year in Afghanistan, that would be the cost of what we have spent entirely now in Afghanistan. So when they say, you know, what are nonprofits doing? Nonprofits, if they collapse, there'll be major unemployment and other things. This is in the service of the nation, people don't realize. Just imagine If there were no foundations, you won't have University of Chicago, you don't have Stanford, you don't have Northeast, you know, just go around, hospitals and so forth. It's the part of American ethos, and we should not knock it. We should criticize it, we should fix it, we should allow, not allow all the abuses of it, like creating a foundation where your husband is the president, the wife is vice president, the daughter is chief executive officer, and somebody is in charge of the accounting and so forth. It's a family enterprise. Charity begins at home. There are some instances like that, but they're rare. We should not allow abuses of few to be carried about all the foundations. Foundations are accountable. We are subject to Attorney General's review. We pay excise taxes, which universities don't pay, for the investment and others we do. We issue annual report. We have independent boards that should be more independent than clients. All of these criticisms are valid. But to say that nonprofits are not taking care of Americans is just asking too much.
You have a lot of experience, Bartan, raising money and bringing money to various philanthropic initiatives. What are there clearly, as you say, there are different reasons that people give, and it really doesn't matter what those reasons are, because what matters is the action. But what are some of the reasons that you've encountered? I mean, when you talk to people, I mean, why do people give? The joy of giving, to see their name on a building, to advance a particular town. I mean, you must have run into lots of different motives and reasons, and which are the most prevalent and the most common?
I'm going to surprise all of you. One of the things that motivates people are institutions that they love. New York Public Library, I have saved only one thing, which I did not have the heart to cash in. Somebody from a retirement home sent me his Social Security annual monthly payment. Said, I don't have money, lot of money. I hope this will help. Because from childhood on, I've been using New York Public Library. So that I consider a kind of return to the source that sustained. Some others have inventors, like Polaroid was invented at the New York Public Library patent division and science division, that it was there that this person had all the chance to develop a product. Some designers, people will forget, came to New York Public Library because you have 1 million picture collection at 43rd Street. See, advertisers, actors, and others. Institutional association. We used to have a children's reading room at the main branch of New York Public Library. Some remember that. So one is replenishing the institution that has helped you. The greatest giving in universities is a scholarship. They remember that you got a scholarship. And now they said, if you can afford it, replenish that so somebody can do that. It's not vanity. It's kind of return obligation to help others. There are those also who like name buildings after them. Fine. And it's competition. If you look at the New York Times Sunday style section, you see there are many people who love organizations. They keep organizations. And I myself have believed, for example, it was obscene to have a dinner at Waldorf Astoria to honor Sister Mother Teresa to fly all the way from Calcutta to give a check while eating dinner and drinking at the Waldorf Astoria. I thought the entire evening, say, this evening we're not eating, we're giving money entirely. But that would be flop in New York. So that's another kind of giving.
Yeah.
Another kind of giving is, I propose, not much happens, that if people get divorced, they don't want somebody to get the other half of the property. I said, give the whole property to your public library. So, anyways, but vanity is one. patriotism is the other one, sympathy is the other one. The fact that they are, like the talk we spoke about, individualistic, but part of a societal fabric. And so that's, people give for different reasons. Some religious, some social, some political, but everybody gives. And I said, I never have questioned their motivation. Because you go into motivation business, then you put in some people hypocritical. That's not the point. The point is, you have a chance to build a mansion for you in France. You chose instead to give to the public. So we support that, we hail that as a choice.
But the impulse to give is as old as man himself. I mean, you look back and there are various forms of philanthropy. You find debt forgiveness in ancient Mesopotamia. You find in Rome, public citizens are giving public works, baths, aqueducts. Even you can say that the gladiatorial games was a form of bread and circuit was gifted to the Roman people. Christendom has a long history of Christian charity. First of all, what other... it's two questions. The form that philanthropy takes in America is a democratic thing. I mean, is it a new thing in the world? Really coming out, I think, of pain and already present in the American consciousness and society in the 1830s before it reaches its maybe golden age with Rockefeller and Carnegie toward the end of the 19th century. I mean, what other forms of philanthropy are now abroad in the world? I mean, what is going on in Islam, for example?
Well, Islam traditionally was a percentage of your earnings you had to give. As a matter of fact, in Pakistan and Libya, the rulers decided they'll collect, instead of you giving directly to charity, they'll collect it from you to give. It becomes like almost taxation. The 10% will take it from you. That's what General Zia did in Pakistan. He collected so that he can give to religious institutions and others, became a benefactor. Gaddafi tried the same thing. But usually you give to religious or cultural backups, which is endowment foundations. But the idea of creating big universities and so forth was left to rulers in many ways. Remember also, people did not want, in various countries, to show their wealth. It was considered ostentatious. World War II changed that. I grew up in a town in Tabriz where you could not see anybody's wealth because it was walled in houses. All wealth was inside the house. You showed your best silver, best curtains, best to select people who came to your home. You did not parade them. It was considered nouveau-riche, ostentatious, and so on, and dangerous because the ruler will know what you have. When they want to tax, they know what you have. So you did not demonstrate that. Now it has changed. Even those areas, people are trying to show their wealth by building now in hospitals, universities. Namazi family, for example, in Tehran built, Shiraz built biggest hospital, not the state, private money. Private universities now are being funded. As a matter of fact, you read in the paper, Rafsanjani, former president of Iran, who was denied the right to run for election, he funded a university called Azad Liberty right after with his own money. So it's an obligation to give. The form is left open. The act is a private one between you and God and you and everybody knows that you're not generous. In the past, actually, for your curiosity, if a dervish came, asked for water or food, you did not give, he would plant grass there and park in front of your home with a tent until the grass grew. And you had to give him water and feed and so forth. So it was cheaper to give him right there rather than invite a kind of sit-in, year-long or half a year sit-in of these beggars who are there. And one thing, till today, is an obligation to give water. If anybody asks for water, you have to give water. It's an act of piety, charity, and humaneness. Even when they slaughter the sheep, they give water and salt before they slaughter the sheep. Again, same thing. Sure. So you're asking me what prompts that? Some is act of power, and powerful enough to become, to descend to humanity, my basic humanity, by forgiving somebody. It's a great power to be able publicly to forgive. And also, naturally, in history, we know it impressed the public. It was Machiavelli who said, don't kill anybody or punish anybody without having a probable cause. The whim is not good. Whim creates enemies. Predictable thing was important. So human nature, to be blunt, is so complex. You never know what combination of all of this do it. I, for one, I was touched, became completely humane, I should say, when I read Victor Hugo's Les Misérables. When Jean Valjean, the thief, is told by the priest, tells the police that I gave them these candlesticks that he stole. That showed a great act of Christian charity, and it converted him. So sometimes acts of kindness transform people. When on death, almost you're on being executed, and suddenly the ruler forgives you. That makes a great impression about he's mighty enough to forgive you, mighty enough to spare your life. And those are things are disappearing, but they have been always there in traditional culture, especially Muslim.
A last question, and I'll ask you this question, and then we'll open the conversation to anybody in the room that would like to ask you a question. But you've been in philanthropy for 60-odd years now. And I associate the philanthropic spirit with the democratic spirit. Now, have you, and I think you do too, and have you noticed over, the last 60 years, an expansion of the philanthropic and democratic spirit, or a shrinking of the democratic spirit? I mean, again, you read the stories about American decline, and what they usually come down to is about a shrinking of the democratic impulse to share, birthday of the new world, and so on, and the selfishness that's implicit in the ever-increasing distance inequality between the spoils taken by the rich and the scraps left to the poor, and that division that's been going on for the last 20 years. So how do you read the tea leaves? I mean, I know we have among us people of extraordinary generosity, people like Soros and Turner and Gates and Buffett and many of them, but how do you see any change of heart, one way or the other?
Well, I'll tell you one thing I've seen happen. We are again, once again, in the Gilded Age, in many ways, where you judge by what you have rather than who you are. I put quite a lot of emphasis about character, and not everybody can cope with success. It's how you cope with adversity and tragedy that makes you, you know, builds your character. But I also see the rise of cynicism, tremendous cynicism in this country. And that's a very corrosive force undermining all our institutions. A cynic, I was told once, is an idealist who's got disillusioned. But now, many of them bypass the phase of idealism. They directly go becoming cynic without even having an idealist. And it's nice for cocktail hour discussion and making fun of people and so forth. But that fabric, that fiber that kept us going as a nation, that we believed in certain things, is weakened in many ways because we have all the presidential campaigns that follow congressional thing. We no longer mention the poor. We no longer mention upper class, middle class, lower class, because that's un-American. We say middle class only. America has only middle class, no poor. But that's not true. We have many poor. We acknowledge they are poor and they need support. And through programs and charity, whatever it is. So the cynicism that emerged when you see the divisions between the two classes, and that we don't acknowledge poverty, what the solutions can be. Second is we lost faith in politicians. That is something new, because we always had idealized. And I've been here since 1956, America. So I've seen this happen. Because when you see lifestyles, when you see differential, so forth, that doesn't mean that Americans are against the rich. This one thing surprised me. We did a study on inequality through Russell Sage Foundation. 70% of people who make less than 25,000-30,000 are for repeal of estate tax, because when they make their first $4 billion, they don't want the $5 million to be taxed by government. Because everybody believes this is a land of opportunity, and I don't want to be denied when I become rich to be taxed.
We're all expectant capitalists.
Yes, they are. They are. So I'm just saying it's not an anti-capitalism, it's disappointment that it doesn't involve all of them, fairness. America's main thing, whether it's sport and others, has been concept of fairness. Fairness in everything we do. And with that weakens, our society will weaken. So I've been fighting against all kinds of forms of cynicism, because it doesn't allow a serious conversation. You know, you say all politicians are crooks, all politicians are this. We demean the foundations of democracy, because they're us. We elected them in many ways. They represent us. And as a professor and college president, also feel guilty. This is a generation we have sent to Congress. They're all college graduates from good colleges, good universities. So where did we go wrong? That's another thing. People say you did not prepare the workforce for America, but nobody said what kind of elite have you produced for us. That's also what we should do with it. So main thing is how to cope with our problems honestly, and then see who will perform what. Naturally, nonprofits have their role too, and government has the other. But most importantly also is how to respect each other as individuals. All the criticism against the philanthropies foundations in 19th century and even 20th century have been that it robs the individual the right. It overwhelms the individual, these organizations. Well, we've gone beyond that. Now, the main thing is how you can keep these associations multiply so they don't become monopolies. If we have 1.4 million nonprofits, we're okay. If we have only 10, 15 foundations and organizations that run everything, then we're in bad shape. Because they can control public policy without going through democratic phase. That's what it is. They were perceived in 19th century as dangerous, 18th century, because they were perceived as lobbying organizations, factions. Both Adams, Federalist Book 10, and George Washington, a farewell address, all of them were worried how these factions, these associations, were not responsible to anyone, can take us apart.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I have no further questions. Does anybody have a question? Do you want to run the question part of it?
Well, I want to ask a question.
Okay.
I'd like to know from you, Barton and Lois, what was your first act of charity? What was the first check that you wrote?
The first act of charity, I hate to tell you this, you're going to say it almost sounds silly and stupid, prompted by Jean Valjean in Beirut when I was very cold, I saw a poor man, shivering, and I gave my coat to him. I never told anyone that till today, because it was an act of charity, kind of compulsion that I had to do this, because again, I had read about how you help somebody for without asking. I was cured of that a couple of years ago. We had a similar situation in 92nd Street Y, when they asked, where did you know you were a real New Yorker? It was Ed Koch was there, a few people, Adam Alda, and so forth. So I said, when I gave 75 cents to this elderly woman on 757th Street, who was on crutches, he chastised me, he said, no change, only paper money. And the fact that I gave him a dollar, I knew I was a New Yorker. So that was my first impulse.
Mine was similar. My first impulse was to give money, in this instance, all of my allowance to a poor person on the street in San Francisco in the Mission District when I was about 10. I mean, that's, and it was just, again, it was an impulse. I wasn't old enough to write checks.
Well, we have time for just a few more questions, and then the doors will magically open, and there will be a bar and a bunch of magazines. So, please.
You already spoke about why people give. I'm curious about the challenges faced by different institutions based on their mission in encouraging people to give. And you've had the experience of being at various different types of foundations. How does it differ to do this work for a library as opposed to a university, as opposed to a large foundation?
I would die to ask money for myself. I just get petrified. But when it's a cause, I have no problem. I learned it. Universities is easy. This is fun to raise at universities, especially if you have alumni, happy alumni. Look at Stanford. I don't know where Curtin raised $5 million. I did not even know they were in the middle of the campaign. But Silicon Valley and all their graduates, they write checks and so forth because they expect for them to do it. Small organizations, very difficult to raise funds. Again, because you either have to have a beneficiary, believe in society, believe in the cause, and also to have lower overhead support. United Way got suffered a lot when its compensation went up, medicines. So, easiest for universities. It was a very great challenge in New York Public Library because I was lucky. I was not responsible for its revival. I was fortunate to have Mrs. Astor represent society. John Goodfriend was here, just left. He represented Wall Street. Andrew Carnegie at the Carnegie Andrew High School represented the publishing media, and then Richard Solomon, Jewish philanthropy, and Madison Avenue. He was the father of Madison packaging, Charles Ritz. So I was fortunate all of them had certain segment. But also, the love of your public library was such that I could not fade. As a matter of fact, one evening my wife was having dinner in an Italian restaurant, and the woman came, stood in front of me and said, what's wrong with me? So I beg your pardon. How come you never asked me for money? You know, it was just one of those things. I said, well, I'm so sorry. I get your address. I got the address. I asked. I never got it. But the point I'm saying is, it was great to go because you're asking, we had District Lions dinner, which helped a lot, 21 tables only, each one 210 people limited. We had no speeches. We welcomed everyone. They sat with authors. We made authors glamorous to dine with an author for 10 people and all the author's books on the table. We initially charged 10,000, and then when I read that social register of Washington Post, what with points. Highest point society standing was to be invited to have dinner with the Queen of England. That was 3,000 points, but there it was. Second one was to have a table, literally lines at the New York Public Library. When I read that, I raised the price to 25,000. Nobody canceled. And I had even the temerity to call Mrs. Edith Hart, who was waiting for a table, to add. I said, I'm happy to announce you at long last, somebody's come to Florida, but you can have, she gave 50,000. So, but then, and then all the liquor salesmen sent us liquor for free, and the books for free, and pretty soon there were 100 dinners in New York, everybody showing how imagining. But it was love of the library, because we never, I never thanked anybody. I never introduced anybody at the dinner. I said, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, you've come to the library. Before they were leaving, I said, thank you for coming. You receive more than you've given. That was my speech. Nobody was introduced as famous person and so forth. Because that was the old public library spirit. And it was easier to raise money for that democratic spirit. Because the old public library equalized people. It tied the past to the present and the future. And everybody felt great about it. They loved the institution. When they love an institution, it's easy to raise money. So much so, when my portrait was done at the old public library, I was telling Lewis, Marshall Rose, who became chairman later, he said, that's not your portrait. I said, why? He said, we have never seen the backs of your hand all these years. It's only the palms of your hand.
Which is true. Which is true. But, so that was it.
Yeah, it's time for you to get a tattoo now. Anyway, thank you both for this inspiring evening and conversation. Maybe we can continue it out there. Okay. Thank you all for coming.
Well, thank you. Before we leave, I'd like to say one word about Lewis and his magazine. Yes, I want to, because that's why I came. I have been a faithful reader of Harper's for many years. I still am a subscriber. And I've been a faithful reader of Lapham's Quarterly and his articles. He's one of the most erudite, cultured gentlemen I've ever had the pleasure of reading, knowing. And those of you who have not, don't have seen us in Lewis Lapham's Quarterly, you're missing an entire education. Each issue is one semester learning for 1 year. So I'd like to congratulate him for this idea and for you, Manuela, for starting this year. I'm glad the two of you could come now together. Thank you very much.